Hey, everybody. I'm Evan Farmer, and welcome to Disaster Diaries. I'm here with my co-host, Andy, and we're here to interview people who have literally lost everything and survived to tell us how they rebuilt.
I'm Andy Kruger, the CEO of BuildSOS, a disaster resilience company, and we're diving into the human side of disaster recovery.
All right, so thanks for tuning in, and without further ado, let's jump into today's episode.
All right, so Joe, he's actually the one who started BuildSOS. I used to work with him years ago for somebody else, for this oil guy down in Louisiana, and we were involved in a number of things together. And then so he had the initial idea for this contractor identification card that started in 2007 or 8. I helped him out early on. And then when I came back to run BuildSOS, he had developed that into the kind of the BuildSOS brand. You met Evan, right?
How you doing, Evan?
Hey, Joe. Good to see you, man.
What's going on now, Joe?
Right now? It'd take me another 3 hours to tell you, so let's just get into this.
So get yourself back into the space of Katrina. I'm assuming it's Katrina that's going to be your disaster you're talking about.
First, a little bit of background. As a public works director for 13 years prior to Katrina, I had stumbled upon a career change, which happened in May of 2005. And I was the director of public works, managing a total city infrastructure. But at the same time, I pioneered the first hazard mitigation grants for the state of Louisiana. There was only 50 people throughout the country invited to participate in Project Impact, which was in Virginia. And it was right when Homeland Security was really getting started and funding for FEMA was ramping up, and was at Mount Weather. So all this is context of my situation that occurred when Katrina hit. Prior to May 1st, 2005, I was heavily entrenched in disaster resiliency, recovery, and city planning a lot of different pre-disaster programs, which was unheard of at that time. So that's kind of the context of what I was dealing with. When I handed off that career, basically that curtain fell and I wasn't really attached to any type of volunteer programs or anything going forward to expedite any of those things I learned or implemented through Project Impact and disaster preparedness. So when the storm hit Louisiana, it was so devastating that nothing like this had ever occurred.
Which storm? You're talking Katrina, right?
Katrina.
Yeah. Okay. So you had some experience in disaster planning, your public works director.
Totally. I had created a lot of what's in existence to today on hazard mitigation and community resiliency programming for local that represented with the initiative, which at that time you never spent money on preempt solutions. You always reactionary. Why not cut the tree down? It's going to fall on the house before it falls on the house. And that day it was let the tree fall on the house. And that's why you have insurance, it'll fix the house. So when a storm was coming into the Gulf, it was that, I think, Saturday night, whatever, I had called my new boss slash partner where I had left the city to go work for, and his office was in Corpus Christi. And I said, look, we got a storm coming in, and it's going to be bad. What do you want to do? And he said, well, I'm going to start, you really think people need to evacuate? And I said, let me tell you, I've just got a phone with Mary Landrieu, and she asked if she could stay up in Covington. She was a senator at the time. And I said, that wouldn't be very smart. If I was you, I'd go to Baton Rouge because this storm is coming right at us and you don't want to be in St. Tammany Parish or along the Gulf Coast area. We immediately started evacuating family and friends to Corpus Christi through our company's ability to have planes, to fly the planes over to Corpus, pick them up in either Beta Springs or Hammond and bring them to Corpus. So we got all of Lee's family out and got a lot of other friends out. I had people that were close to me that wouldn't be able to go. So my wife and I decided we're going to stay and we're just going to go to Baton Rouge.
Joe, how did you know that this one was different than the other ones? Right? Because I was down there at the time and it just seemed like another storm coming in.
First of all, being involved in Project Impact and being involved in storms all my life, I was watching the news that night and I saw what the storm looked like in the Gulf. And I was like, this thing isn't going to stop. It's going to come. We lived in Mandeville near the lake. So I said, Sandy, we need to at least get everybody up to North Covington where our satellite office was with our company that I was working for on what we call the ranch. We'd expedite people from there, different directions where they should go to evacuate. So we locked our house down, took pictures of everything, raised everything because we were in a raised house that was underneath the house, left to go up to Covington. And from Covington, people would meet there and would bring them to that local little Hammond Airport or a beat or where the planes were coming in to evacuate personal family and friends. We had just bought a house for my son to go to college at LSU. So we said, well, we'll just go to Baton Rouge after we get everybody out of here and we got everything locked down. When the storm was 8 hours away from hitting land, we drove the back roads because by that time, all of the interstate was packed. If you got on the interstate, you were going to sit in traffic for maybe 10 hours to get from Covington to Baton Rouge or from Covington north to Jackson, Mississippi. So from the house or the ranch, I knew I could go up north through some small roads and highways to get to what we call Highway 10. And believe it or not, there wasn't one car. We just drove straight to Baton Rouge. I'm thinking, you know, why don't we have better evacuation plans at the time? There's nobody out here on this road.
So you feel like your public works director, Fremont, you got that mindset, yeah?
Absolutely. We had five cars with people packed in them, leaving the ranch to go to Baton Rouge where we stayed at Blake's college house. We get to the house and obviously the storm comes and you kind of know that you have no idea what's going to be your house or other people's houses are going to look like locally in the Mandeville area. But we knew that we got the worst winds of the storm, but really Mississippi got the direct hit. Mandeville got hit hard and our house got hit hard. But come to find out, we had no leaks, no nothing. We did have flooding underneath the house. So the main thing was after everything passed, we made our way back to the ranch, you know, so everything was kind of fine. And then we're sitting at the ranch. We had to cut our way into the ranch because the trees were all over the place. There was an older gentleman and his wife that stayed at the ranch in one of the little houses. We had to get to them because there was no power anywhere. But the back house, had, we had 125 kW generator back there. That house was up and running. So by the time we got back there, we were able to put, you know, the satellite TV on, whatever it is, the dish TV antenna. We had a big screen TV and the rest of the world's going along its own functions. And we're watching what's going on in New Orleans. And you're seeing all the stories and helicopters and all the stuff flying around New Orleans. And New Orleans is devastated, but the levees hadn't broke yet. About 24 hours later, when the levees broke, all hell broke loose. So we're sitting there watching everything going on. And I'm calling the previous mayor that I worked for in Mandeville. And I'm saying, hey, what's going on with y'all? And he's saying, well, we got all of our non-critical workers out, but all the essential workers in town. I said, how can I help? I mean, I know I'm not working for you anymore, but what can I do? He said, well, right now we don't have any fuel. Nobody could get fuel. We couldn't even get fuel driven in from out of town. So the first thing we did was I secured a guy that I knew owned a filling station that hadn't flooded. And I asked him if I could procure his tanks from Mandeville so we'd have diesel and gas. And he gave me the keys to the station, brought them to the Mandeville folks. And I said, look, there's no power, but you can use a generator and pump fuel, but you got to keep a tally on it and be honest. And you have to pay the man for his fuel. So he probably had about 100,000 gallons of fuel at his fuel station. So Mandeville PD was up and running. They had fuel. Mandeville Public Works. And no other communities in the area had fuel because they depleted it by that point. On top of that, New Orleans is now a war zone. And we're just watching as we're trying to help the people close to us because we couldn't go to New Orleans and help. We were helping the people on the North Shore that needed our help. So with our oil and gas company, we were able to secure generators from out of Texas, come in the back way like I came in because you couldn't drive I-12. And we brought in tractor trailers of a bunch of generators and we gave them to whoever needed them. We weren't charging anything. We were trying to help. We provided a generator for a nursing home that didn't have power, West Causeway. We provided generators to Mandeville for all of their lift stations that didn't have power, so the sewer could come back up and running. Meanwhile, This was kind of the funniest thing. There were no banks open, so there was no money. There was no stores open. Most of the stores gave their food to the police for the workers. So Winn-Dixie and different stores would call and tell the police chief and the mayor, look, if you need any of our food before it perishes, come get it and feed your employees or feed citizens that need food. So that went on at Mandeville PD and City Hall as we're doing all this other stuff. Meanwhile, Mary Landrieu's calling me to say, what do you think we ought to do? And at that time, the mayor of New Orleans was Ray Nagin. Mary Landrieu was our United States Senator. Our governor was Kathleen Blanco. We had a real problem with politics and people getting along. So I'm working at this micro level, but I'm also getting called from a U.S. Senator saying, Joe, what would you do? We had lost a significant state senator, which was Johnny Hankel, about a month or two before. He was on a hunting trip and he died of a heart attack in his sleep. And to this day, I say if Hankel would have been there for the recovery of Katrina, you would see a complete different recovery plan, because he was leadership that could have pulled everybody together properly with Mary Landrieu and shed through the politics of the time. We had Bush, we had Ray Nagin, and we had Kathleen Blanco, and we had General Honoré, which was a cluster without using the other word. There was so much crap going on.
Did everybody have a different plan on how to solve things?
Everybody was on their own islands, Andy. Horrible. So the one thing I did tell Mary was that, look, you know, you got two companies in the state of Louisiana that locally needs to be at the table, and that's Shaw with Jim Bernhardt and Robert Bow with Bow Brothers Construction. But you know, nationally, the national firms are going to come in and try and be the middle people on the federal money that's going to come in here. So I'm dealing with macro level discussions. And then I get Jerome worked for our company, and his father was elderly and he was in Baptist Hospital. So while we're getting that issue handled, the mayor was telling me we don't have any way to pay our employees because there's no banks open. So I went to my boss slash partner and I said, look, what are we going to do? They don't have any banks. He's got to pay his employees so they can pay their families that are out of town to buy food and pay their bills. So I called the finance director and he said, well, I need X. He said, well, I'm sending a plane with a suitcase of money, cash. While that's happening, I called and say, hey, Jerome's father is in Baptist Hospital. Now, this is on national news, and his father's stranded where people are trying to go to the roof or get put in boats to be brought out the facility. So we ended up getting his father airlifted from Baptist Hospital with a helicopter to Slidell Memorial. Jerome went and picked him up and brought him to Evita Airport. And the plane that brought the cash, we put Jerome's father in it, and they flew him up to Birmingham or Jackson, somewhere up in Mississippi, Alabama, so he could get to a regular hospital that had facilities. You're sitting there going through all this, and then you're watching people in the Superdome that are stranded, and you're watching people on the interstate that are stranded on I-10 in the Central Business District, and you're sitting there watching people at the convention center waiting on buses to come get them, stranded. All they have is water being thrown at them. Then on our big screen, I was sitting at our big screen, and now at this point, we've moved in maybe 20 people into the 20,000 square foot house that we have up in the woods. And I've got one guy that works for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that's going across to New Orleans every day with his gun and go and rescue people in an airboat. And he's camping out in the evenings at the ranch, right? You couldn't move around that much because you had to have, you know, these colored placards to drive on the roads.
So why the gun?
Well, because there was a lot of shooting going on in New Orleans. Then I have the mayor's sister calling me saying, hey, do you have a boat that we can bring dog food and cat food across the lake to feed all the animals that are in Lake Terrace that have went to the highest part of land around Robert E. Lee in New Orleans, mid-city New Orleans area? So we got boats, filled it up with cat and dog food, and I started sending our workers back and forth across the lake every day to feed the cats and the dogs. Meanwhile, these people, elderly family that we didn't fly out, third generation, 80, 70, 60 years old, and they're all New Orleans style cooks and old grandmas, and they're cooking breakfast, lunch, and dinner for us. Red beans on Monday night. So there's this stratification of total different emotions because I needed to be able to communicate. There was no cell phones. So I gave Mary Landrieu a sat phone. I gave all the political leadership sat phones that we gave them to use at what, $5 a minute? So for the first 3 months, we funded all communication between the local leadership. So we got generators, sat phones, boats, and money. So we brought in enough money for about, I guess, 4 months of payroll for Milton Stibe, being the finance director, to sit there and do envelopes and do his payroll for his public works and police department personnel, because that's the only ones that really stayed. In the meantime, we got a resort up in Covington that you watching on television disaster emotionally, and you want to help, but you can't help in a macro way, which I was normally accustomed to. As being a director of public works, I had a lot of other resources that I could expedite to help a whole city. And I'm just sitting there watching how everything's failing. And then you had Mississippi that was in much worse shape, believe it or not, but New Orleans was getting all the media.
I was just curious because I remember this period of time, and I remember, you're right, New Orleans got all the attention. I had houses in New Orleans at the time, but I wasn't actually physically there. And so I was following everything. And do you think it's because of the crime and sort of all that chaos that was happening in New Orleans that it was getting all the media attention? Because media, you know, if it bleeds, it reads. Or why do you think they forgot about Mississippi? Because it too was completely devastated.
Believe it or not, Mississippi was worse. I had gotten a few jobs and I had my employees helping in Mississippi. And one of my employees recently committed suicide, was on the team that would go to Mississippi every day and search for bodies. He came to me afterwards and said, Joe, to this day, I have nightmares, because he walked everywhere and was finding bodies. All right. And none of that's as publicized as the people standing in front of the convention center, or the Superdome, or the bridge, wanting water or getting helicoptered pallets of food and stuff. Poor Mississippi was just devastated.
Why didn't they get the attention?
I think, first of all, New Orleans is a major city. I think that the flooding was played out to be more significant than the acute damage that the hurricane did to Mississippi, because they didn't have the flooding. They just had a surge and then out. So they were dried up. They couldn't use anything because it wasn't there. They were wiped out, but you could still travel around and people just lost everything. So they were displaced. Whereas New Orleans, you had a lot of live bodies still there sitting on roofs. And it was a great narrative for filming too, right? And the culture of New Orleans and international focus of New Orleans got international attention.
Didn't you have also the stories about like the cops that were looting alongside and all that sensational?
Well, I was going to go into that. I had a friend that was inside of the police fabric. What you saw on TV was factual, where people walking in 3 and 4 feet of water with TVs on their shoulders and looting like crazy. It was such a bad display of people and their reactions of what they were doing at the time. And remember, we're watching all this. We're like, what the hell? And then you have people wanting water and you have guys walking down the street with 50-inch plasma TVs on their shoulder. Where are you going? What are you doing? And then you have people getting put in flatboats at a hospital, trying to be brought to high ground to get in a military vehicle to be brought where? 50 miles away, 60 miles away? Be able to be taken care of. Then you have rumors of, you know, the people that couldn't get out of bed being euthanized. You know, you have rumors that the snipers were shooting people from helicopters. You have loads and loads, and this is factual, of refrigerated trucks with bodies in them. The response was just not what you would think a normal society would do.
You know what I'm hearing? Because it's really interesting. Your position and your background of logistics, getting things done, taking care of people, making things happen like that, and having the benefit of being just outside the main damage. And I hear mostly how helpless you felt because you were aware of everything with this inside baseball knowledge of how it could be better. And yet it wasn't. And then you're watching it unfold on TV like some sort of awful, horrific reality show.
When I saw the levees break, and look, my brother-in-law was the head engineer for the levee board. To this day, I felt what they should have did was bring one of the largest vessels they possibly could have up that canal and over to the two places where it failed and jam that ship in that spot. It would have let water through still, but the city wouldn't have filled up as fast. And they could have responded. I think they would have, it was a time element. When those levees broke and they took so long to figure out, he was the one that decided to start airlifting the sandbags in to dike the levee and then to bring in the people to drive the sheet piling to fully contain it. My position would have been, look, sandbags are too slow, because they were bringing in UE helicopters with a typical pallet, one large sandbag, and just dropping it, right? And I felt that I watched days and days of that and water just like coming in. And I felt that an obstruction in that canal would have been much better. If I would have been in my old position, I probably would have been able to go there and say, hey, commandeer this ship in Mississippi River, bring it through the industrial canal, bring it up that canal and jam it, you know, or block the water off at the throat of the canal. Once again, when you're in the forest, it's hard to see the forest through the trees, right? So I'm watching it on a 30-foot big screen TV. It's helpless, right? And I'm obviously can't get in touch with my brother-in-law to say, what are you doing? He don't have a sat phone. Communication was everything. That, if you learn something, now we have Wi-Fi, right? We didn't have it then. We didn't have the robust ability for satellite phones then. I mean, the dial a satellite phone was a pain. And when you got on it, it was a hard conversation, but you could talk. But it's still, you're looking at $5 a minute or $6 a minute. And trust me, those bills were huge that Lee never did get reimbursed for. We did get reimbursed for the generator cost, and we did get the cash back that we gave the city. Wasn't a loan, but we weren't looking for that. They called Lee and said, what do we owe you for all this effort? Meanwhile, I have 17 workers that work for me full time. So I expedited those guys to start going clean houses and helping people, not for pay, but to start helping anybody you can help.
I want to dive into, you were talking about a while ago, you're sitting in the ranch, you're sitting in that large house, you're watching it all happen, you've got food, you've got all this. I think a lot of people after a storm are thinking, what can I do? How can I help? And they might feel very limited. You were in a unique situation where you had political figures on the phone, right? And you have resources and you're so well connected down there. So you were in a position to really to do a lot more than a lot of other people. And I'm curious, for most people, you can shrug it off and just say, what am I supposed to do, right? Other than look after maybe my family and my neighbors and make sure they're okay. But you had the capacity to do so much more, and you did do so much more because you had it. But do you ever look back and think, I could have done more with the resources I had? Or it's a different situation.
Yeah, there was another level of that. I was in the forest too, right? And I think that what I should have did was I should have drove to Baton Rouge and sat next to Mary. I didn't do that. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I was that level of person. And probably I could have made a bigger difference if I would have thrusted myself into the middle of that. I never recognized, and still I don't think that I'm at that level of political clout, so to speak, or presence. But I think that I should have gave it a shot. I should have left somebody else in charge of what my little world, like Jason, and I should have just communicated with him to see how things were going in tabs. And I should have drove up there and spent my whole time at the higher level of helping the symphony. You know how I always refer to, I like to be the guy in the press box kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That could have been more effective that way.
And just for everybody out there, Jason is your colleague, right? He was helping you run your construction
company. Right.
So when you had these calls with and from people in power, were they surprising to you at all what they're asking for? I mean, when I think of a leader in these situations, I think of somebody calling up and saying, here's what needs to happen. Can you help me get it done? Are you getting calls of what should we do next? And were they asking for advice or were they asking for you to help execute something?
Mary, in the beginning, was asking for advice. But then when the powers that be and the movers and shakers got in the middle of it politically, there was no more need for advice. This game plan and the stage was set, and I wasn't going to be part of directing or helping the narrative. You know, I just wasn't playing that role. We didn't have a Senator Henkel to play that with. And we had a Ray Nagin that was kind of rogue, and he was off balance because, truthfully, Ray's a good guy, but he got played like a pinball in a pinball machine. He wasn't sophisticated enough to understand how to be a true leader in this situation. Mary's a federal senator. She doesn't get to call the shots at the local levels. So there was no leader.
Would you say Build SOS was born out of that frustration? Because what you've put together is a system of resources. You've put together a place where you can help people be resilient ahead of time and after a disaster. It sounds like you had a lot of frustration with how things should have been. And then here's this great organization that's designed to solve a lot of those problems.
I think Andy describes it the best is that when you look back on traditional scenarios, it's a bunch of silos and people get comfortable in their silos and it's kind of their turf now. So you get all these different ways of managing your silo and they don't communicate with each other very well. The default is the 16 flood brought me together with some other type leadership people that had the same concerns about the residential industry and how it functions, not only on a day-to-day basis, but in a disaster scenario and a scenario of preparedness. Project Impact kind of threads it all together under one quilt, you know? So that's what we've been trying to do under the shield to Build SOS is take the silos and let them still exist with their comfort level and their strength and their turf and their politics inside of the silo, but break down the barriers and the fears of letting loose of connectivity and communication. So that it's an art of letting these groups feel like they haven't been diminished in any way by being part of a bigger whole. And I think that's what Build SOS represents. It's a shield everybody can stand behind and say, we trust the Build SOS process and we want to be involved, but we're still our little group. We're Red Cross. Don't be telling us how to be Red Cross, right? Or we're Catholic Charities. Don't tell us how to be Catholic Charities. Or we're Home Depot. Don't tell us how to do disaster response. We're Lowe's. Or we're City of Mandeville. Or we're State of Louisiana. Or we're the United States government. Everybody's got their comfort places on the chessboard. And all we're doing is trying to eliminate the lines in a gentle way to get everybody to say, hey, good. That's great. Play your role. But you know what? There's a bigger mission here. Let's work on the purpose. Let's work on the mission so we all function more efficiently. That's it. With transparency. So we're not doubling up. So we're not using energy in the wrong places when we need it in the most direing times. I don't want 20 people doing the same thing when one person is over here drowning, doing something that five of those 20 could be over there helping with that.
What is the mission of Build SOS?
To me, it's always been to provide a level playing field with consistency and transparency for the residential building community that relates to all six audiences. And the six audiences, the primary audience is the homeowner. The next audience would be the mom and pop contractor, builder. The next one in my mind, and this is hierarchy, would be the subcontractor that supports the builder. The next one would be your nonprofits in time of need. So now you've got the person in need, whether it's not involving disaster or involving a disaster. Then you got the support, which is primarily the primary contractor, home builder, husband and wife, whatever, with their team that supports them. And then when it's not financially available, you go to nonprofits. You go to the nonprofit families to help that mission. Then from there, it's the material suppliers, the vendors. And then it's your three government agencies for oversight and code and health, safety, welfare, the general public, which is government. And that's your audiences. So let's streamline them. Homeowner, builder, subcontractor, nonprofit, vendors, manufacturers, banks, all the support stuff, and then the government. BuildSOS sits in the middle, trying to connect all those folks through integrated systems where they can jump on and jump off as they need in both directions. And we started that out in 07 with Andy early on in between 07 and 10 with Cardia Contractor. And it would be a self-policing program for the homeowner to actually police the industry by utilizing, hey, if you don't have a BuildSOS ID card, I'm told that I should at least check your background. And I'm educating the public, right? I'm not expanding government to do this. I'm empowering the citizen to say, hey, there's something out there that relates to your shelter and your home and your requirements for your housing. That's a free tool. And here's the agencies that all take part in that as a success. So at least card your contractor. Primarily, it goes straight down to the builder. We need to get that person carded first. And then that person has to get his subs carded. And then the nonprofits, the volunteer should have identity, should have the ability to say, I'm a volunteer and I work with Red Cross. And here's my membership and here's my card. I've been background checked or whatever. The Florida Katrina ramped this up and it was sitting idle. And then Billy Ward and I got together, and Billy was on a task force for the governor on curbing contractor fraud, which I got involved with him on at the state level through people I knew when he said, I'm start coming to these meetings with me. And that's when I went, and he was gone by that time, and I introduced Cardia Contractor because we let it sit idle for a while, and everybody loved it. And once again, one big silo didn't like somebody was infringing on their turf, and it happened to be the Louisiana Home Builders Association. They didn't want to be carded. They didn't want to be transparent. They didn't want to have to prove that they had workman's comp insurance. They didn't want to have to say honestly that they have two sets of books and they're only paying workman's comp on 20 or 40% of their workforce. And I'm one to say, guys, if we're all playing by the same rules, then it's competitively fair. But if we got a cheating program out there, it's unfair to our profession. It's unfair to the homeowner. It's unfair across the board. But if we're all practicing the same practice in the system, then I can be just as competitive as you. Now it comes down to the quality of service you deliver. But they don't want to hear that, okay? The majority of these builders have come up through, I'm competing with a guy that works out the front seat of his truck, Storm Chaser, here we go, that comes in with no license, no insurance, no credentials. But I kept telling them, those are the people that are branding the industry. That's why we are looked at as criminals. Contractor. Let's take the con out of contractor because we're builders. And let's stand up proud and say, hey, here's my card. Introduce it to the homeowner first and tell them, make sure if you get a quote from somebody, get it from somebody that's at least competitively competing with me fairly. On the flip side of that, most of your homeowners out there are just as corrupt. They want to get the $100,000 quote for insurance replacement and spend only $50 and put $50 in a new car. Well, that's insurance fraud, believe it or not, as it's written. That's complete insurance fraud. And we wouldn't be paying the type of premiums we're paying now if the insurance companies, the brokers didn't say, well, in the game of gambling, I got a hedge on the amount of corruption out there. So I'm going to just make my policy premiums account for that. Now with AI, it's even better because the actuaries used to tell the guys in the smoking room, look, you got to charge 42.9% more because that's what Our numbers tell us that the thievery is going to be out there for a claim. They're getting it on the front end. They're never going to lose money. The insurance companies, they got it better than Vegas. At least Vegas, they can't fudge the odds unless they're fixing the machines. The insurance industry is the most profound legalized gambling effort in the world. If we don't have legalized gambling, what is insurance?
Well, I definitely lost the house during my house fire. I can tell you that. I was not did not get a new car. In fact, I lost a pile of money. But
okay. But let's go back to that narrative for a second, okay? Let's say you lost a house and it was valued at $2.3 million. And I come up to you and I say, hey, it's going to cost you $2.3 million to rebuild it. And another guy comes up to you and says, right below 2.3. And another guy comes up close to that. Three of us come up and we're all legitimate, honest as you can be, working in the industry. And then another guy comes up and says, I can do it for 2.7. And you say, why would I go with those guys? Well, 500,000 less. And you do that. The guy said, yeah, I'm insured and I'm licensed. But he didn't check. In his mind, he is licensed. He has a driver's license. In his mind, he has car insurance. So he didn't lie to you. You just didn't ask the right question. Now, a lot of those go well, right? You get it done. He had to cut some corners. He definitely had to cut some corners. Or he just didn't make no profit, no overhead. He thought he made money. He's just living day to day. He's not building a business. He's not cultivating the industry. He's not doing any of that. Or he's telling you, hey, I'm putting GAF shingles on the roof. And he goes and buys third-hand shingles that look like GFA shingles. You don't know any better. That's your problem. But at the end of the day, you pocketed that $400,000. You didn't call the insurance company and say, hey, I got some competitive prices here. And you know what? I'm getting it done for a lot less than y'all giving me. I'm going to give that money back to you. You'd never do that, right? Because they've already ripped you off on the front end by making you pay a high premium. So your conscience is, look, I paid my premium. I'm getting my money. But at the end of the day, when your job goes south and it's in the fourth quarter of that job, and that guy skips town on you and doesn't finish your job, you're not telling them you didn't use the $3.2 million contractor. You used the scumbag that wasn't licensed, or you used the guy you got had. No, the media is talking to you, just like you asked me earlier, why were they looking at New Orleans? They're going at you because it's a story, right? Now, they're saying, don't give anybody any money. Don't give anybody a deposit to do your job. I'm like, wait a second. I'm getting penalized because of the scumbag majority out there that is working out the front seat of their truck. How do we fix that? We fix that by card your contractor. And you know what? If you don't ask to card your contractor, it's a chain of custody. Now you go on the media. I can say, hey, did you card your contractor? No. What is that? Well, you had to know about it. There was PSAs about it. I know the other three contractors who gave you quotes showed you their card. Why didn't you call your contractor? Because you're just as much of a crook as that contractor. So you made your bed, live in it. But stop damaging the industry.
I'm looking at this as a homeowner and saying, what can Build SOS do for me? And hear me out and see if I've got this right. It streamlines the recovery process and it acts as a watchdog for the consumer, which in turn also acts as a watchdog for the good folks out there, whether they be in contracting, insurance, all of the six pillars. Did I nail it?
Yes. Now, through our system, when you card me and I card you as a homeowner, because you can have a card too. It's just a homeowner in our system. In our system, we're triangulating that as a geo reference, timestamping it, right? So everything that happens after that consistently is now a chain of custody. So instead of going in and trying to recreate where the problem occurred, you can say, oh, it happened right here. Week 8, something went messed up. And it's because of this. Whereas I've been in situations where you have to recreate 9 months of information because in this industry, there's not enough money, like in commercial construction, to have that chain of custody so well documented because the lawyers, right, are in the middle of that. They can make a case out of anything. So we're almost on the fly keeping track of relationships between the six audiences on a specific project or a specific location or a specific event through our system.
All right, I got one last final question because I know we got to wrap it up. But this is something that Andy and I started doing with all our homeowners that we've interviewed that have been, you know, through a disaster. So it's, what would you say to someone listening who just lost everything 5 minutes ago?
Well, I would ask them what they need first. What are their acute needs? So that would be my first statement tool. Then I would ask them, what did you do to prepare to see where we're starting at? Right? Because if they're well prepared, then I have a different path for them to take. If they're not prepared at all, then I got to get them started. I got to center them. I got to ask them to take 10 steps back. It's not the end of the world. Take a breath. Don't sign any agreements on the fly. Don't get pressured into doing anything quickly. Nothing's going to change in 24 hours. Nothing's going to change in a couple of days. Stabilize yourself to be able to make good decisions.
And use the Build SOS resources. You can.
That's part of our tutor and our model. At the end of the day, the Build SOS Shield should be something they navigate to. Go to the website and search out any information you need. And if we don't have something you need, contact us and ask a question. We want you to be part of our team.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you've got a full plate constantly running around saving the world. So thanks for taking an hour or two to talk us through what you do and your experience.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe. Talk to you later.
Hey, thanks for listening to Disaster Diaries. And if you're moved by these stories that you've heard, please subscribe, leave a review, and share the show with someone that you think needs it. And to tell your own story, download the Disaster Diaries app, available at all app stores, or visit disasterdiaries.com. And if you're looking for help rebuilding, check out buildsos.com for support, tools, and resources to help you better prepare for, respond to, and recover from disasters.